Good morning. I think we have critical mass now, so we are ready to begin. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for making it here in the cold and slippery conditions that we're experiencing today. Good morning and welcome. My name is Jeff Brez. I'm the chief of NGO Relations, Advocacy, and Special Events. Many of you will remember Maria Luisa Chavez. She is retired, and I have taken over her duties in working with the NGO section. And this is the first briefing of the winter season, so it's my first briefing in this position, and I really look forward to working with all of you. So thank you very much as I learn the way and for your support. And I think we're going to have a fantastic year and years ahead. So as usual, before we begin, we'd like to ask you to silence, but please don't turn off your cell phones. And we ask you not to turn them off because we'd like to create a different kind of buzz today, not the buzz of a phone call, but a buzz of social media. So as you know, if you're using Twitter or Facebook or any other social media, it's a way for you, both if you're in the room or if you're joining us via the webcast, for you to send in questions and participate and generate a discussion around what is such an important topic. So please don't hesitate to do that. Keep your devices on, but just try not to have them ring and be a part of the conversation. And again, those of you joining us via the webcast, we will be monitoring both Facebook and Twitter. So send us comments either on Facebook or on Twitter using the hashtag DPINGO for Twitter. On Facebook, the Facebook page is UNDPINGOs, Partners for Change. And I think you also have that, you can see it up on the slide. The International Day of Commemoration in Memory of the Victims of the Holocaust was designated by the UN to encourage awareness and remind the world of the threat posed when genocide and other crimes against humanity are allowed to occur. The past briefings commemorating the victims of the Holocaust in previous years here at the UN have focused on untold stories from Greece, Morocco, Turkey, and Bulgaria. Today, we will continue this tradition by observing the 70th anniversary of the deportation of the Hungarian Jews. Today's briefing is the first event in a week-long series of activities that the Holocaust and the United Nations Outreach Program has organized in observance of the International Day of Commemoration in Memory of the Victims of the Holocaust, and we really encourage you to participate. You're very warmly welcome at the other events of the week. We have exhibit openings and film screenings, and it all culminates with the main event, which is the memorial ceremony in the General Assembly Hall on Monday, January 27th, with none other than Steven Spielberg. Now, I'm sure you'll all want to be there. This is a tickets-only event. It doesn't mean that it's closed, but of course there'll be a lottery system. So in addition to the ticket, you need your UN's grounds pass. So please, a calendar with full details about how to register is available here, and it's also available on the Holocaust Program's website, and that is www.un.org, that's the easy part, /Holocaust Remembrance. So it's un.org/Holocaust Remembrance. And again, copies are available in the room here for the events coming up over the next week. So today's session will share the personal stories of individuals affected by the Holocaust in Hungary. During this time, Nazi security police worked with the Hungarian authorities to systematically deport Jews in 1944. In less than 2 months, almost 440,000 Jews were deported and sent to Nazi concentration camps. The remaining Jewish population in Hungary continued to suffer from, quote, race laws that barred Jews from civil service employment, economic opportunities, and social opportunities, and from associating with non-Jews. It is estimated that from an original population of 861,000 people considered Jewish inside the Hungarian borders of 1941 to 1944, about 255,000 survived. So that's less than 3 out of 10. Just under 3 out of 10 survived that period. So to give us a better idea of this moment in history, we are extremely pleased and honored to welcome our notable panel of speakers. Dr. Carol Rittner, Distinguished Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies with the Richard Stockton College of New Jersey. Agnes Vertes, Hungarian Holocaust survivor and award-winning documentary filmmaker. And His Excellency, Mr. Csaba Kurosi, Permanent Representative of Hungary to the United Nations. So without further ado, I would like to give the floor to Dr. Carol Rittner. Dr. Rittner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have a PowerPoint here, so if the Holocaust in Hungary is a complex topic, one that today I can only deal with in broad generalizations. For those of you who want to know more, I would recommend the work of Dr. Randolph Bram, particularly The Politics of Genocide, The Holocaust in Hungary, and his new three-volume work, The Geographical Encyclopedia of the Holocaust in Hungary. I also recommend another book of essays recently published by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, The Holocaust in Hungary, Evolution of a Genocide. Here is a map of Europe. By June 1941, when Hungarian troops participated alongside German troops in the invasion of the Soviet Union, Hungary, as you can see, was virtually surrounded by countries either occupied by or allied with Nazi Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Yugoslavia. Here is another map that shows the approximate Jewish populations in various European countries on the eve of World War II. In Hungary, according to the 1941 census, there were about 825,000 Jews, which was less than 6% of the total Hungarian population. This figure included 100,000 converts to Christianity, who under the Hungarian race laws passed between 1938 and 1941 were classed as Jews. The Hungarian racial laws were modeled on Germany's Nuremberg laws. They reversed the equal citizenship status granted to Jews in Hungary in 1867. Despite the fact that by 1942, Nazi Germany dominated Europe and was furiously rounding up, shooting, deporting, and murdering Jews all over Europe, the Jewish community in Hungary was, until the spring of 1944, relatively speaking, somewhat spared from the worst horrors of the Holocaust. The great irony is that this last relatively intact Jewish community in Nazi-dominated Europe was liquidated in a swift and ruthless campaign launched immediately after the German occupation of Hungary on March 19, 1944. By the time the Nazis and their Hungarian collaborators were finished, more than 437,000 Hungarian Jews had been sent to Auschwitz. There, in that Nazi German place of horror and misery, Jews and more than a few non-Jews as well were burned alive, starved, shot, gassed, and cremated. Their ashes scattered to the winds. Those who survived Auschwitz, and relatively speaking, there were not many, were barely alive at the end of the war. In his powerful memoir, Night, Elie Wiesel, the well-known survivor of the Holocaust, recalled his arrival in Auschwitz. And I'm quoting here now. "Not far from us, flames were leaping up from a ditch, gigantic flames. They were burning something. A lorry drew up at the pit and delivered its load. Little children, babies. Yes, I saw it with my own eyes. Those children in the flames, A little further on was another and larger ditch for adults. I pinched my face. Was I still alive? Was I awake? I could not believe it. How could it be possible for them to burn people, children, and for the world to keep silent? End of quote. Of course, I do not have an answer to Elie Wiesel's question, but I can say this. The success of the Nazi final solution of the Jewish question in Europe depended to a very large extent on the cooperation, or at least the indifference and passivity, of the non-Jewish populations under Nazi rule. This was as true in Hungary as it was in other parts of German-occupied Europe. At the very least, the Nazis needed a European population that would not offer significant resistance to the harsh measures taken against the Jews. In other words, the Germans needed bystanders who would not interfere with their dirty, rotten killing business. And they found them, standing on street corners, peeking out from behind window shades, lurking in dark alleys. During the Holocaust, the Jewish survival rates differed enormously. It ranged from 95% surviving in Denmark to 90% dead in Poland, Latvia, and Lithuania. Why the incredible variation in rates of Jewish survival across occupied Europe? Clearly, the difference lay not in Jewish behavior, neither in passive nor armed resistance. Armed resistance was a decision how to die, not how to live. Nor was it in Nazi behavior that made the crucial difference, because it was murderous everywhere. The single critical difference was the behavior of the bystanders. This was as true in Hungary as it was in other German-occupied countries during the Holocaust. The Jews of Hungary were not victims of devastating, destructive war, and World War II was devastatingly destructive. No, the Jews of Hungary were victims of genocide, a genocide organized by a modern European country, Germany, led by a modern political leader, Adolf Hitler, and perpetrated against a defenseless civilian population, Jewish men, women, and children. The Holocaust was the central act of the Nazi German state during the Second World War. It was an attempt by the Nazis and their collaborators to exterminate 6 million Jews. On March 10, 1944, Adolf Eichmann and his principal subordinates met in Austria at Mauthausen concentration camp in order to work out a deportation program for the Jews of Hungary. A week later, Hitler summoned the Hungarian regent, Admiral Miklos Horthy, to Klessheim Castle. I think my PowerPoint is off. Keep on going, please. Right there, okay. A week later, Hitler summoned the Hungarian regent, Admiral Miklos Horthy, to Klessheim Castle near Salzburg, Austria. Horthy agreed to deliver 100,000 Jewish workers for the German war effort, but he was reluctant to agree to a general deportation. At 9:30 that evening, Horthy's train left Salzburg for Budapest. The next day, German troops moved into Hungary. On March 19th, the Germans arrested some 200 Jewish doctors and lawyers, their names chosen at random from the Budapest telephone book. All were deported to Mauthausen. The Gestapo then moved into hundreds of Hungarian towns and villages, prepared a list of all Jewish wealth in each town, took the leaders of the local community into custody, and then threatened to shoot the leaders if the money and valuables were not forthcoming. The technique was devastatingly successful. It drained the communities of money so that they could not even pay bribes. After the Gestapo released the community leaders on payment of the ransom, It made their threats seem plausible. They had done what they had promised. Provided that the Jews conformed, they would keep their promises in the future. It was all part of a massive deception intended to lull the Jews of Hungary into thinking that as long as they did what the Germans demanded, give over their money and valuables, conform to what the German occupiers ordered and demanded, they would survive, as they had always survived, during persecution, wars, and crises. Little could the Jews of Hungary imagine what awaited them. Eichmann and his so-called deportation experts completed all preparations for rounding up and deporting the Jews of Hungary in less than 2 months, 56 days to be exact, March 20th to May 15th, 1944. One of the first things Eichmann did when he arrived in Hungary was to summon Jewish leaders in Budapest to a meeting with him. He ordered them to establish a Judenrat, a Jewish council, with whom he would deal when it came to Jewish affairs. This was followed by a law mandating that Jews wear the yellow badge. The order went into effect on April 15, 1944, less than 3 weeks after Nazi Germany occupied Hungary. In addition, Jews were removed from all liberal professions. Their bank accounts were frozen. They were forbidden to engage non-Jews to do housework. And they were forbidden to travel or to own and use telephones, cars, and radios. The first reaction of the Jews to these anti-Semitic measures was shock, followed by a state of paralysis. Then, with the enthusiastic cooperation of the Hungarian gendarmerie, Jews were rounded up, isolated, and put into ghettos. This began in the Hungarian provinces by the end of the first week of April 1944. Within less than a month, ghettos for hundreds of thousands of Jews sprang up around the country. On May 14th, the full-scale deportation of Jews from the Hungarian provinces to Auschwitz started. At the rate of approximately 12 to 14,000 deportees a day. The Nazis and their Hungarian accomplices were successful in achieving their ideological objectives largely because of the confluence of several factors. For one thing, the occupation enabled the German and Hungarian Nazi elements to unite and coordinate their anti-Jewish efforts. Foremost in this drive were the SS units attached to the Eichmann Sonderkommando and the Hungarian Nazi elements associated with Laszlo Béky and Laszlo Andra, the two virulently anti-Semitic undersecretaries of state in the newly installed Quisling government of General Dom Tóge. In Professor Randolph Brahm's opinion, the decisive factor in the destruction of Hungarian Jewry was the wholehearted cooperation of the Tóge government, appointed on March 22, 1944. 3 days after Nazi Germany's occupation of Hungary and 14 months before the end of World War II in Europe, an Allied victory. While a relatively small number of Hungarians actively opposed the Nazis, and some even risked their lives to save Jews, a proportionately large number of Hungarians collaborated with the Germans for ideological reasons or to advance their private economic interests. And an even larger number simply stood by, as bystanders often do, neither collaborating nor cooperating, but not opposing either. I want to say a word about the Christian churches, one of the main institutions that could have helped to stem the anti-Jewish drive of the Nazis and their Hungarian collaborators. The great majority of the Hungarian population were Catholic. A minority were Lutheran. And while Pope Pius XII did join other leaders in trying to intercede with Admiral Horthy to stop the German operations against the Jews, he was ineffective. His message, cloaked in piety, and worded in hazy terms, never even referred to the Jews as such. Such lack of papal forcefulness did not encourage the head of the Hungarian Jewish hierarchy, Cardinal Justinian Cerriti, to take any bold steps of his own. The papal nuncio, however, Monsignor Angelo Rata, was far more outspoken. He tried to sway Cerriti toward more active protest, but to no avail. A few Catholic bishops did courageously speak out in their diocese, but they were lone voices that did not have a major impact on the attitude of the Catholic people. Individuals did what they could, but it was not enough to save the Jews of Hungary. By mid-1944, the Hungarian authorities, in coordination with the German security police, were systematically deporting Jews. By the end of July 1944, the only Jewish community left in Hungary was that of Budapest, the capital of Hungary. While Adam Horthy did order a halt to the deportation of the Jews on July 7, 1944, the Germans supported a coup d'etat against him and his government. They arrested Horthy and installed a new Hungarian government under Ferenc Zalasi, the leader of the fascist and radically anti-Semitic Arrow Cross Party. During the Zalasi regime, Arrow Cross gangs perpetrated a reign of terror against the Jews of Budapest. By November 1944, nearly 70,000 Jews were forced into an overcrowded, stiflingly small ghetto in Budapest. And as late as November and December 1944, the Arrow Cross regime, using Hungarian guards, force-marched thousands of Jews in the bitter cold to the Austrian border. Many perished there. Others were shot along the way. Soviet troops, fighting their way west against the dwindling might of the German army, helped save the remaining Jews of Hungary. Of the approximately 825,000 Jews living in Hungary in 1941, about 63,000 died or were killed prior to the German occupation of March 1944. Under the Germans, another 500,000 died from malnutrition or were deported and murdered. Some 255,000 Jews, less than one-third of those Jews who resided within the March 1944 boundaries of Hungary, survived the Holocaust. Without the cooperation of hundreds of thousands of people in Hungary and all over Europe, without their knowledge of local areas, the Nazi final solution would have been far less deadly. Enthusiastic and efficient Hungarian support was essential for Eichmann, who had a job to do and a mission to accomplish. And he did that job, and he nearly accomplished that mission, with help and in record time. We cannot undo the crimes and wars of the past, nor can we recall to life the millions who died during the Holocaust. We can, however, turn memory of the Holocaust into the force that drives us to engage in the work of Tikkun Olam, healing and repairing our very fragile world. Let's try to do that. There is no lack of oppression, hunger, poverty, and sickness in our world, in our country, in this city of New York. Let us do what we can, where we are, with what we have to help others. And let us resolve, as a result of our participation in this program today, to never be a perpetrator, never be a victim, but never, never be a bystander. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rittner. Next, we are very pleased and honored to have with us Agnes Vertiz, a Hungarian Holocaust survivor and award-winning documentary filmmaker.
Good morning. I am very happy and very lucky to be here. because it wasn't meant to be. And I will tell you, there were several times when I would have been nothing but smoke. I was born during the Holocaust. I was born in 1940 in Budapest, Hungary, of a well-to-do Jewish family. And in 1944, at the beginning of 1944, the Allies were bombing the city of Budapest because it had one of the largest industrial complexes in that area, owned by a Jewish family. Manfred Weiss was the owner. And they were able to make war machinery. So that's why the Allies were bombing it. And of course, the factories were already taken over by Germany, and the Jewish owners negotiated their release from the Germans, and they were outside the country already. Anyway, the bombing was going on in Budapest, and my family thought that my sister and myself and my mother would be better off going to down into the countryside to a little town called Kiskörös, where we had family who had vineyards, and evidently there was no interest in bombing the vineyards. So we were down there, and then came March 19th, 1944. That is a date that no one who lived there at the time we'll ever forget. It's like our 9/11. You'll never forget that. And everything has changed on March 19, 1944. Now, there were Jews already taken to slave labor as of 1941, but the women and children weren't taken yet. And those who were taken for slave labor were men between the ages of 18 and later even as old as 60, because my grandfather was taken and he was in his 50s. And they followed the Hungarian army, many of them to the Russian front, but they had no weapons. They didn't have uniforms. They had to supply their own clothing. They only got half of the rations of the soldiers, and they had to wear the yellow star. If you were a converted Christian, in other words, converted from Judaism to Christianity, you had an armband with a star, also a Star of David, but it indicated that you weren't a complete Jew, let's put it that way. But anyway, so this went on from 41 on, but the, as I said, the women and children were still okay. Now, my father was taken, and when he saw that the train was going towards the east, he jumped, and he saved himself. Of course, there were lots of complications after that, but I don't want to go into it because there's limited time. Now, we were down in this little town, and all of a sudden, my father came and he said, you know what, you better come home, because in a small town, everybody knows who is a Jew, but in a city of a million, you can get lost. And so he was taking us back, and we went to the railroad station, and every time we tried to get on the train, they pushed us off. And it didn't take a genius to figure it out that it was because both my mother and my father were wearing the Jewish star. The Jewish star you had to wear on your outer garment, and it was about, I would say, 4 or 5 inches in diameter, and it had to be a certain material, a certain yellow color. And if you didn't wear it, there was severe punishment for it. So I don't know how my father got down on the railroads, because as you heard, previously, Jews were not allowed to travel on the railroads. And so my parents did the following. My father picked me up and covered the yellow star with me. My mother covered the yellow star with my sister. We got on the train, and the train was chugging along towards Budapest. And then all of a sudden, either I moved or my sister moved, and somebody noticed the yellow star. Well, what happened after that, you're not going to believe. They wanted to throw us off the train. And there were Hungarian soldiers there who were supposed to keep order, but they were with the crowds. They didn't care about us. And some different soldiers came from another car, and they said to them, "What kind of people are you? You want to throw little kids off a train?" And then a fight started, and all I remember, because I was not quite 4 years old at the time, that they were kind of rolling on the floor, and my father said, "As long as there is confusion, let's get out of here, because no matter who wins, the Jew loses." And then he said, "We should go to the last car, because as the train approaches the main railroad station, it slows down considerably, and we should jump, because anyone who was caught in the train station or even in the vicinity of it has been picked up and never heard from again." My mother thought it was a crazy idea, but anyway, the train did slow down, and my father jumped first, then my mother threw me to him, then she threw my sister, and then she jumped. And so we got home. That was a great thing that we got home. And I don't know how we got home. I don't remember that. The next thing I remember is that I was told that my name has been changed, and I am no longer Agnes Katz, which was my maiden name, Katz, because it's a very Jewish name. I became Agnes Kovacs, and I was no longer Jewish, I was Lutheran. And I learned all the little prayers and songs that children should know, four-year-old children should know. And the reason being, because before the Second World War, everybody's birth certificate also listed the religion. And so my father, who was a very prominent person, he simply went to City Hall and bribed somebody, and they made these false certificates on the actual paper that they usually use for birth certificates. So I was also told that I shouldn't even mention the word Jew, and I should never tell anybody my real name, because I will get killed. Now, to a four-year-old, what does it mean to be killed? Really, it doesn't mean anything. But I knew that if my parents didn't want me to be killed, it must be a very bad thing. So I kept it to myself. And one day, a lady came and picked up my sister and took her away. And then 2 weeks later, my mother washed my hair in like petroleum, because that's the only thing they had to kill the lice. And I was supposed to be a little girl from the country, and those kids had lice. So the lady came, and this time she came for me. And she said to me, "I don't want you to make a peep, because no one should know what's going on here. Because as you heard, most people collaborated, and they would go and tell the authorities that something is going on here." And she told my mother that, "Don't follow us. And I don't want to hear crying or anything, because, as I said, nobody should see what's happening. So she took me, and she picked me up, and I could see back because I could see over her shoulder, and my mother was following us, and I saw that she was crying. But I was told not to say a word, so I didn't. And then we got to the tram, and as we got on the tram, I still saw my mother. And as the tram was going on, she got smaller and smaller and smaller, and then she disappeared. And then it just hit me. I was devastated. I've never been away from my parents, especially my mother. And I didn't know who this woman was. I didn't know where I was going. It was a terrible feeling of insecurity. And I did cry. When I arrived at the place where this woman lived, it was a shack. I have never before or after seen a place like that. It had packed dirt floors. There were no facilities. There was electricity, but no running water, no toilets. And my sister was already there. She was only 2 years old. So we were together, the two of us. And the lady was a very nice lady. She was what we call a righteous Christian. She was very poor, and she had a foster home. And my parents did pay her. But you know what? She didn't have to do this, payment or no payment, because she risked her life saving two little Jewish girls. But, of course, the Allies were bombing. And one day, this was completely destroyed. And she got word to my parents that we have no roof above our heads, and she has to return us. Now, while we were there, my father's friend from university, who was a retired colonel from the regular Hungarian army, who incidentally was hiding my father, he used to come and bring whatever he could get on the black market, some food, so we should have some more food. So this woman knew him, and my parents sent him to pick us up. And she said to him, "No, I can't let these children go. I have to go with you because I promised the parents of these children that I will never, ever give them to anybody else except to them." Now, how is that for a person with a soul? Unbelievable, nice person. When we got back to my mother's place, who was also hiding on the Pest side of Budapest, we had to find another place for us because my mother's story did not include two children. So she couldn't keep us there. And we were going from place to place, trying to place us. And I remember one time we were on a tram and the air raid went off. And it was near the neighborhood where we used to live, so my mother felt we shouldn't go down to the cellar because maybe somebody will recognize us and turn us in. So we were just in the lobby of an apartment building, and of course the bombs and everything else was horrendous, the noise and the explosions. It was absolutely horrendous, and I was frightened out of my skull. We Jews were also, we could be victims of the war as well, not just the persecution. But when this was over, the tram car we were on was turned on its side and was completely burnt out. Now, finally, they did find a place for us. And that was on the Buda side. The Danube River goes in the middle. It's a beautiful city. It still is, and it was then too. The mighty Danube in the middle with many bridges. And we were placed in the home of the former mayor of the city. Of course, he didn't live there anymore, but there were, together with us, 100 Jewish children and some adults. And so you can imagine, even if you have a big house, 100 children is a little bit much. But it was okay because we were taken care of. Only one problem. Every single day, either the Arrow Cross, which we called Nyilas in Hungarian, or the German Nazis came to look for Jewish children. And every time they came, as long as the adults had some drinks, they gave them the drinks, and nobody knew that my sister and I were Jewish. So they put us up front, take a look. These are the children that we have here, and they showed our birth certificates and everything, and usually they left. And then one time, a pair of real nasty Hungarian Arrow Cross came, and when they did the trick with us, they said, we want everybody's papers. Now, you can imagine those who understood what that meant, their blood must have curdled. And at that point, my little sister, who just learned to talk, ran up to this nasty Arrow Cross man and pulled on his trousers. And she said to him, "Hey, Mr. Soldier, can I try on your cap?" The Nazi melted. I mean, the Arrow Cross melted. Picked her up, threw her in the air, and said to his companion, "Can anyone but an Aryan child be as cute as this one?" And they left. 100% Jewish. And this is the story I like to tell when I go. I go a lot to talk to students in high schools, in middle schools and colleges. And this is kind of a cute story in a very dark story. So anyway, this is how my little sister saved 100 Jewish children. After this, the house-to-house fighting became an everyday thing. The Russians and the Germans were taking positions. One day it was the Germans who were owning this particular area, another day the Russians. And one particular day, the Germans decided that they were going to drag up all their machine guns and everything on top of the house, on the roof, and the Russians were already at the end of the garden. And they were shooting at one another. And we were inside, all 100 children. We were taken down to the main level, and all the mattresses were brought down, and all the high furniture was pushed against the window that was looking at the garden, so that if a bullet comes in, it has to go through the window, the furniture, and the mattress. And this was the only thing that my little two-year-old sister ever remembered, how we were shaking with fear underneath that mattress. But we weren't there long because the house caught fire. And the Germans came down from the roof, and they didn't want to let us go because they were crazed with hunger. And they said, "The children can't go until we get food." Who had food? You know, when house-to-house fighting is going on, who is crazy enough to go out and open a store or go shopping, or a peasant bring in food to the city when he can sit nicely in his home in the countryside? So we had no food. And then one of the women somewhere found some flour. And by the way, all through the war, we had water. So she promised them that if they let us go, she will make them pancakes. So they let us go. Now, it was probably one of the coldest nights, And this was probably the coldest winter ever there. And that was very fortunate because there would have been an incredible epidemic in Budapest if it weren't for the cold winter. So I was already four, so I had to walk. My sister was picked up and she was carried. And I was stumbling over the frozen bodies. There were bodies and body parts frozen into the street. And I stumbled over a woman's body, a frozen body, with her eyes open. And I got so scared, I couldn't even make a sound. And somehow, when I was on this woman, and she was so cold to the touch, and I realized, so this is dying. This is what it means to be killed. And I was only four. And after this, we had a very difficult time. The first night, we found a place to sleep in a barn. You know, the hay is very good. It keeps you warm. But the next day, they split us up, and I and my sister were with the young kids, and I don't know where they got a sled, and they were pulling us with a sled. And then it was, there was a storm brewing, and we never met anybody on the street except dead bodies. And then all of a sudden, like a mirage, a person appeared. And then when the mirage started running and she came close, was my mother. Pest was already liberated and Buddha was not yet liberated. And Mom came across. She gave her gold watch to some Russian soldier who was supposed to get her across the Danube. There were two of them, and somehow, I don't know what happened, I wasn't there, one of them fell in and drowned. So the other one who remained was so angry that he put my mother out on the island, which is in the middle of the Danube there, Margit Island, it's called. And as far as I know, what my mother told me was that the river wasn't completely frozen, but you also really had to be very, very good at navigating the water. But she had no boat, so she said she hopped from ice block to ice block to get across. And she went to the place where she thought we were, and it was burnt down. So she went to the Red Cross, and they said, we know that everybody got out, and just go and try to find them. And she was heading to the place of an incredibly righteous person, the Reverend Stalo. The Reverend Stalo was a formidable person. He saved about 1,000 Jewish boys. And you know, it was much more difficult to save Jewish boys because only Jews were circumcised in Hungary. And even if you had papers and you were walking on the street and they had a dragnet, you know, and they asked for your papers, even if the papers were all in order and they suspected you were Jewish for whatever reason, they made you drop your pants, and if you were circumcised, you were gone. So anyway, Mom found us, and we all went to the Reverend Stalo. The Reverend Stalo, unfortunately, had no room for us, but he let us sleep there that night. And the only thing he had to give us to eat were canned asparagus, a couple of stalks of canned asparagus. I hated them all my life. And So that night, we slept on the floor, and I said to Mom, you know, I dreamt, I had a bad dream. I dreamt that Mamatsi, that was my father's mother, her name was Tsili, and we called her Mamatsili, Mamatsi. So I said, Mamatsi was on the floor and in a pool of blood, and nobody helped her. And my mother said, don't be ridiculous. They are here somewhere in Buddha. They are hiding, and they're fine. Okay. Next morning, I don't know why, I never asked, my mother left us, and she went back to Pest. After this came the worst times, because we lived on the street. We had no place to go. It was terribly cold, and what we did, we ate the snow. We ate the snow, but we were okay until they put us into a home. I don't know what kind of home it was. I know it wasn't Jewish, because every Sunday we had a service, and it wasn't a Jewish service. And afterwards, we got in a small bowl 3 or 4 white cherries. I looked forward to that all week long. And I still adore the white cherries. And one day, my sister got very ill, and they separated her. She had high fever, and evidently they thought she was contagious. They separated her in a different room, and I was desperate. Now I'm going to be all alone in the world. If they take my sister away too, I'm going to be all alone in the world. So anyway, I went to see her practically every hour on the hour, but I didn't have to do that long because I became very sick too, and I was put there too. I was so sick, I had open sores on my body all over. It was hell, and I was full of pus all over. I suffered terribly, and we were almost dead by the time the first temporary bridge was built by the Russians, and my mother came across, and I don't know how she found us, but she did, and so I can be here to tell you the story.
Ms. Vertese, thank you so much. Really, I don't think there are words to describe how appreciative we are that you shared your story with us and your experiences. So really, thank you for sharing that with us. Next, I would like to invite His Excellency, Permanent Representative of Hungary, who we're extremely appreciative to have with us, Csaba Gurosi, to speak. The floor is yours.
Thank you much, Jeff. Indeed, a very moving and very shocking story. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning, sharing your experience, your story, sharing your thoughts, sharing your emotions. I would like also to recognize some of my good colleagues who are in the room, thanking them for being with us. The permanent observer of the Holy See, the permanent representative of the Netherlands, and just left but was here with us, the permanent representative of Slovakia. Professor Rittner mentioned some quotations from Elie Wiesner. What I fully share. Let me also add some other two ideas coming from wise persons. One is Joseph Conrad, who once said, the real significance of crime is its being a breach of faith with the community of the mankind. The other one was said by a French cardinal, François de la Rochefoucauld, who said, "We easily forget crimes that are known only to ourselves." As Jeff said at the beginning, about 580,000 Hungarian Jews and about 100,000 Romans died in the Holocaust. All of them citizens of my country. Based on the recommendations coming from the Hungarian Jewish organizations, and with a view of remembering and finding out more about the tragic events of the year of 1944, the government declared the year of 2014 as the Hungarian Holocaust Memorial Year. Let me convey to you some messages on behalf of my government and on behalf of my nation. The Holocaust Commemoration Year provides an opportunity for the whole nation to face the past and apologize. We owe the victims an apology, as the Hungarian state was guilty of the Holocaust. Guilty in two respects. Firstly, because it did not defend its own citizens from the extermination. And secondly, because it assisted and provided resources for the genocide. The institutions of the then Hungarian state were responsible for the Holocaust. This apology must be made a part of national memory and identity by the Hungarian state. So the goal of the memorial year is to raise awareness about the tragic loss of the Hungarian nation suffered socially, as well as in the field of culture, science, and the consequence of the persecutions of Jews and Romans and others in the Holocaust. A special attention should be given to the rescuers who saved countless lives, but they were not many enough. The memorial year will dedicate also much of the attention to the child victims of the Holocaust, a topic which has been too little explored to date. An emblematic endeavor of the memorial year is the establishment of the Child Victims of the Holocaust Memorial European Education Center, so-called. The education center, with a unique approach in Europe, will seek the present the story of the Holocaust from the viewpoint of the child victims. You may know that the education of Holocaust is already an integral part of the curriculum, both in primary and secondary school in my country. But in the spirit of the memorial year, the government decided that every secondary school student must visit the Holocaust Documentation Center or the future child victims of the Holocaust Memorial in order to gain an insight into the period of the Hungarian history. Neither commemorations nor historical research have to be enough have been devoted to the Roma victims of the Holocaust in Hungary. For this reason, the government decided it was priority to also raise awareness of the losses of the Roma in Hungary and therefore officially declared 2nd of August a Remembrance Day. There will be an exhibition opened tonight, organized, prepared, and produced by 4 NGOs. I would like to encourage all of you to join us for the exhibition. As I mentioned, it's an NGO event, but my mission was very happy to support it. It has been produced by the Karl Lutz Foundation, the Lantos Foundation for Human Rights and Justice, the Hungarian American Coalition, and was supported by the Hungarian Initiative Foundation. It is giving to all of us a very honest, fair description of the history of Holocaust, of the history of a certain period of time of the Jewish community in Hungary. It speak and its darkest days. Here, I have to make a very personal remark. This exhibition has been produced by the president of the Karl Lutz Foundation, Mr. György Vámos. 2 days ago, when he, together with his and my colleagues, was coming to this building for setting up the exhibition, he suffered a terrible stroke. Doctors are fighting for his life. I hope they will be successful, although he would not be able to join us tonight. I would like to encourage all of you. Once again, I would like to thank the DPI of the UN for bringing us together this morning. I'd like to thank Professor Rittner, and I would like to thank Agnes Vertes for being with us, sharing their story, sharing their views, and helping us to remember and learn. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. We're going to open the floor for questions. This is an emotional topic. I think that a lot of people are going to have questions and comments they'd like to make. We'd like to give time to as many people as possible, including people who are following us via the webcast, to share their thoughts, ask questions. So please try and be concise. Introduce yourself when you ask your question, and ask your question one question at a time. If we have time for a second question from you after others have spoken, we'll come back to you. So please, try and be concise. And we will look at Twitter and Facebook, so those of you who would like to make comments that way, please do share them now.
Thank you. very much, and I would like to thank the DPI for organizing this event, and the speakers, Professor Carol Rittner, and I was particularly moved by the life experience that was shared by Ms. Berthes. Of course, my colleague Ambassador Carosi for his remarks. I just want to, since I'm here, I feel obliged to make a small comment about the intervention made by Professor Rittner, which I have to do it because otherwise it will be right that if I keep silent about the remark that you made. I appreciate it very much, and I learned a lot from your exposition about the whole history, which was very informative. But I think you should be fair enough when, like some authors, when they start picking on the history of Pius XII, it is not even in Yad Vashem there was a script, a photo script which was written, which has been now modified by the authorities of Yad Vashem. The Holy See has published over 12 volumes of the acts and documents of World War II. It is all on our website. It's all put, and several books about how much Pope Pius XII did to help the Jews, and during the Holocaust, how much he had acted, and most of the time very silently, without trumpeting it out or without publicizing it. And not only Pius XII, there are so many other popes who are directly involved in helping the Jews out of this difficult dilemma and the tragedy that took place. For example, John the 23rd was, by the Jews themselves, was proclaimed as righteous among the nations. Pius the 11th, John Paul II is proclaimed by all the Jews as a friend of the Jews. And you know that, and Ambassador Carosi will know, the nuncios, as ambassadors, they follow the instructions. And if the nuncio in Poland was acting, he was acting following the instructions from the Pope. So when you deal with these historical issues, you should be fair enough and objective. And you should have the facts. You just go to our website, www.holyseemission.org. You will see a tremendous amount of resources that attest to the fact that Pope Pius XII did what he could at that time. But at the same time, I did not particularly like the silence. I don't know if it was intentional or not. Intentional or not, about the big political powers at that time. They had the knowledge, they had the resources, everything, but they did not act in defense of the Jews. And about that, most of the others, they keep a dead silence about it. But they are very good in picking on the Catholic Church, or especially Pius XII. So I just want to make that remark.
Thank you for your remarks. Dr. Rittner, perhaps you'd like to respond.
I would like to respond. Archbishop, I appreciate your comments, even though I was not speaking about John the 23rd or Pope John Paul II, but I believe that you also need to get your history straight. And I did say that Pius XII spoke out, but I said that nobody understood him because he spoke in hazy language. And in Pius, it was wrapped in a kind of piety. That's all I'll say on this point. I do have a book on Pius XII, which I would be happy to send to you. But I would also say that within the last 2 weeks, Pope Francis has announced that the Vatican archives in regard to the period of the Holocaust will be open to scholars. Nobody disputes with you the number of volumes that have been published, but scholars, both Catholic, Jewish, and those who are of no particular religious tradition, when it comes to Pius XII, there is certainly a variety of opinions about what he did, what he didn't do, how clearly he spoke, how silent he was, how secret he was, how open he was. And I think that we have to wait to see what scholars now will discover once these archives are opened and they have an opportunity to look at them. No one more than me wants Pope Pius XII to come out looking good. But at the moment, there is a dispute about it. I totally agree about John the 23rd, Pope John Paul II, and certainly the current Pope, Friends of the Jews. Thank you.
All right, more questions from the floor. Again, try and be succinct, please. Please press the button just below your microphone and wait till it turns red. For those of you watching the webcast, you can send questions and comments to #DPINGO or to the Facebook page. Please.
I'm Alice Kulik. I'm a member of the Work for Women organization. I would like, if I may, address my question to His Excellency. Your Excellency, to what do you attribute the tremendous rebirth of anti-Semitism in Hungary, and what is your government doing as an antidote to that? Thank you.
Okay, if you don't mind, we're going to take a couple of questions. Yes.
My name is Anna Berkowitz. I'm a child of survivors, both of whom were from the villages around Munkash and around Uzerod. My father lost 300 members of his family, and he was, in fact, conscripted into the Hungarian army to be front lines to remove bombs. And my mother survived Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen just barely. I have some records with respect to my grandmother, who died in Auschwitz, but with respect to many, many members of my father's family in the villages, there are no records currently, either in Israel or in the United States, and I was wondering whether there's an effort to translate some of the remaining documents so that those of us who lost family can find records with respect to how they passed.
Thank you, Mo. We'll take one more question before. Yes, sir, in the back.
Chris Hirschler from Monmouth University's Institute for Global Understanding. Samantha Power, in her book, America in the Age of Genocide, has said that one reason why governments don't do anything is because of the political cost that they will incur. And so I'm wondering what we can do to better the system. I'm sure education, K-12 and college, is part of the answer, but what can we do so that there isn't the political cost or fear of the political cost for action? Because, you know, we can all be considered bystanders with the events that unfold, you know, every year in relation to genocide.
Thank you very much. Ambassador?
Thank you much indeed for all the questions and all the remarks. First on genocide. The reason that we are here today is twofold. On one hand, it's very obvious to remember what happened in my country and to make sure it would never happen again. But we are in the UN, and we also need to understand that the oath what we gave to ourselves, never again, never any genocide. If you look out, genocides are going on right now as we speak. So the second reason why am I here today, to reinforce the message that this is not the way we can go. This is not the way we can accept. And this is not the way what we can acknowledge even. The gravest disasters in the human history is the disasters what we inflict on ourselves. We should not and we cannot allow it. On the records. The intention of my government is to dig deeper, not only on what happened, but each and every name that is still somehow could be found and traced back should be kept in their written memory. And for that, the Holocaust Documentation Center has been set up in Budapest. I hope that the new memorial site, which is going to be located on the place of a railway station, by now it's out of use, it is going to be converted into a museum and an education center and the research center. It will also be part of that effort to trace back each and every name, whatever still can be traced back. On the surging, reappearing anti-Semitism in the Hungarian society or beyond, but let's speak about the Hungarian society only, undoubtedly exist. But it does not reflect the majority opinion of Hungary, of the Hungarian society, and it is marginalized both in the parliament and outside of the parliament. One voice, one anti-Semitic voice, is far more that I can accept, far more than we can accept. The only way how we can relate ourselves is zero tolerance to that. To do that, my government is trying to forge three ways: law enforcement and legal measures, the second, Holocaust education and remembrance, and the third, support for a Jewish cultural renaissance in Hungary. Thanks to God, we still have the largest and most flourishing Jewish community in Central Europe, despite the horrible part of the history. If you're interested, either on this plenum or on a smaller format, we can go through what kind of legal measures have been taken, starting from the Constitution to some of the legal measures which were adopted in the last couple of years. There are legislation pieces on hate speech. There are legislation pieces of no statute to limitation of Nazi crimes. There is a criminalization of Holocaust denial. There's a banning of paramilitary troops in my country. And there was a very significant tightening on house rules in the Hungarian parliament on hate speech by the MPs. Beyond that, it is a very, very painful part. The Holocaust survivors can never recuperate their loved ones, and they can never regain the years what they have lost, and they can never forget through what they went through. The compensation what the Hungarian government has paid and recently decided to increase will not solve that problem. It can only help to physically live a decent life. There is also an institution in my country which has been established recently, a sort of open line. Anybody, by phone, by any social media, can immediately place a complaint or report of any type of anti-Semitic activity in the country, be it in open or be it in more private circumstances. It's called the Anti-Semitism Hotline. We know that these measures, never mind how broad, how large they are, will take a long time to eradicate fully antisemitism. I hope many other countries will do their own part in that. But let me indicate something which is very specific to my country. It was a trauma, a huge trauma. In the middle of the 20th century. And that trauma certainly did not come out of the blue. It was prepared. The society was prepared to go through that trauma. As I mentioned, the Hungarian state was guilty. The Hungarian society, which stood by, was guilty. To go to the through the purification needs open speech, needs discussions, needs honest acknowledgments and honest research. When should that start? I would say in 1945, immediately. But there was 45 years when this question was, in a way, framed. And if you wish, put under the carpet. It was a non-issue for the public speech. A society, like we persons are, needs to discuss its problems, needs to understand its problems, because what you lock in yourself, it's not helpful. It is coming too late, but it's coming. And I hope it's coming to the right direction.
Okay, let's give an opportunity to the other panelists to thank you. To respond to the third question, I think.
Sorry, I'd like to respond to the question about Samantha Power's book, A Problem from Hell, Genocide in the 20th Century. What can we do? I think one of the things that Samantha Power said in the book is that one of the reasons why the American government did not respond particularly to more recent cases of genocide, Rwanda, former Yugoslavia, is because the American government did not hear from American citizens. As we all know, congressional people, senators, the White House, they check their telephone calls. They check their Twitter messages. They check their emails. They check their letters. I'm speaking now as an American citizen, and to her point in her book, if we as American citizens don't let our government know of our concern, our interest. I mean, why hasn't the American government done more in terms of Syria? How many of us in this room have made it known to our congressional people our concern? So government, at least the American government, will respond to pressure from American citizens. So education is important, but we also have to encourage our students, others, colleagues, to pick up the telephone, get on the email, send a letter to let people know, because the government will respond to pressure.
Ms. Vertes, would you like to share your thoughts about how we can prevent have governments stop this before it occurs, both before and how they deal with it afterwards?
Is that a question from
someone? Yes.
Well, I do my share to try to educate people, especially the future generation, because they're going to be the future leaders. And I always tell them, do not be a follower. If you think there is something being done that's wrong, don't be with the crowd. and speak up. And also, we have to start the education already at a lower level. For instance, I even speak to sixth graders, and I tell them that my story only illustrates where the hate and discrimination leads. That was kind of the ultimate of the hate and discrimination. And education is the key to it. And I'm doing my part. And the problem is that many people don't want to hear. They don't want to hear. Let me tell you, for instance, when I came to this country and I went to high school, and they said to me, oh, how was it for you during the war? In those days, we didn't call it Holocaust. And I said, well, it was very difficult. They stopped me right there and then, and they said, oh, it was so difficult for us. We didn't have turkey for Thanksgiving. You know, for me, that was not that important. But what I am saying is that education is the first step in preventing anything like the Holocaust or any kind of genocide.
Thank you very much. Dr. Rittner had one more thing to add.
Just in terms of preventing genocide, Elie Wiesel often says, be careful about words, because words can kill. The important thing to remember is the Holocaust did not begin with crematoria and gas chambers. It began with words, with hateful words, with words against Jews and others in society that the Nazis considered less than human. So I think one of the things we have to do is we have to be very careful about the words we use, the words that are used in the media, in newspapers, in classrooms, in our conversations with each other.
Thank you. We have time for one more round of questions, possibly two. Again, please be succinct. I'm going to start with one we received on Twitter, which is one for Dr. Rittner. Why no mention of Raoul Wallenberg? So, and the next question, please, from the audience. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Neil Blonstein, and I have a few short comments that will possibly provoke responses. My NGO is Universal Esperanto Association, founded by L.L. Zamenhof. His three children died in the Holocaust. Thousands of members, Jewish members of my organization, Universal Esperanto Association, died in the Holocaust. I have spoken in Hebrew with the Hungarian ambassador, so I'm certain he might expand on his experiences when he was ambassador in Israel. The ambassador mentioned child victims. Last year, there was special programs on child survivors. And I was with the Israeli ambassador who showed pictures of Peter Ginz. I tried to point out that I met the parents of Peter Ginz, who survived the Holocaust. They were leaders of the Esperanto movement, both in Israel and prior in the Czech Republic. Perhaps lastly, I'll ask if you've read the books of perhaps the most famous Hungarian Jew, who has documented the most famous Hungarian Jew being George Soros. His father wrote several books in Esperanto, which have been recently translated to English, and I was wondering if anybody read any of them. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take one more question. Yes, with the red tie.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Peter Schult. I'm from the German Consulate General here in New York, Politics Department, and I would like to address Ms. Agnes Wörthes. Some years ago, I had the opportunity to talk to Eva Pustoy. She is a Hungarian Jew who survived the Holocaust just like you did. However, she was a bit older, I think, young teenager in 1944. And I found it very impressive what she told about her today's attitude and her today's view back on the things that had happened in 1944, 1945. And I would like to ask you a similar question I asked her. How did you manage to deal with what has happened? And what are your today's feelings if you look back what had been done to you and so many other people in Hungary and all over Europe? I'm completely aware that it's a very personal question, and if you do not like or cannot answer to it, that's absolutely okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, so we'll begin with Dr. Ridner.
I'll respond to just two of these questions, which is the question about George Soros and his father. I actually read the book that George Soros wrote about his father and about the, that his father wrote, and I interviewed Soros in Stockholm last October at a commemoration of the anniversary of Raoul Wallenberg, that the, I forget the name of the Living History Forum put on. And Soros's father and that family, while they suffered, they didn't suffer in the same way that Mrs. Bertes suffered. And in fact, as I read the book, they even profited a little bit from some of the contacts that they made. And needless to say, I was somewhat intimidated interviewing Mr. Soros, and I decided I was going to call him George because I thought that would help. And but it was very interesting. He was very gracious to me, and spoke about his father and some of his experiences. The second question is about Raoul Wallenberg. Why didn't I make reference to Raoul Wallenberg, who's an extraordinary person, but as you probably know, last year was the centennial of his birth, and there were huge commemorations, including here at the United Nations. And you know, one could ask why I didn't speak about any of the righteous. For example, a woman by the name of Jane Haining, whose sister, half-sister, lives in Derry or Londonderry, Northern Ireland, also a righteous. But I was given 10 or 12 minutes, and as I said, I spoke in broad generalizations, but so I couldn't talk about everybody.
Can I just add something to the Raoul Wallenberg question? I have, as you have heard, I am a documentary filmmaker, and I made this film, which is about the diplomats of neutral countries who were stationed in Budapest during that period of time, during the Holocaust. And actually, Raoul Wallenberg is the most famous, but he didn't save the most Jews. It was really Karl Lutz from Switzerland who saved the most Jews. And then there were also other people like Sanz Briz of Spain and Perlasca of Italy. So it wasn't just Wallenberg. And I, when I hear the Wallenberg name, we are eternally grateful to him because he saved a lot of people. But he wasn't alone. And the answer to the gentleman's question, what were my feelings afterwards about going through such terrible times? Well, for a long time, I didn't speak about it because, as I told you before, people here in the United States didn't want to know about it. And the older people, the older survivors said, oh, what do you know? You were a kid. So, you know, you had no place, we had no place to talk about our experiences, so it was bottled up inside. And it was taking up so much of my brain. And you know what? In 1992, 2002, there was a meeting of hidden children. I didn't come to this because I figured a hidden child was hidden in a closet or an attic. I wasn't in a closet or an attic. So I didn't come and I didn't join. But later on in Connecticut, somebody called me and said that, well, you were a hidden child. You hid your identity. And so I became part of the organization, and now I am president of the organization. I'm the youngest one, so I'm the only one who can do anything. And so, well, anyway, my feelings were really, I was fearful. I had terrible nightmares. And you know, when it was over, there weren't psychiatrists and social workers lining up to take care of us. They just said, it's over, get on your feet, and go on living. And it was bottled up until I gave my testimony to the Shoah Visual History Foundation. And then it was like a load off of me because I told my story. Somebody will know, see? And then I had this feeling that, you know, my family had 270 members in January of 1944. In May 1945, we were 70. So 200 of my family were murdered, okay? And I had this terrible guilt feeling that why was I saved? Why not some kid who would have been an Einstein? I am nobody. Why was I saved? And then I came up with this idea that I can do education and I can do films, and I did. And so I resolved my problems that way.
Thank you. Ambassador.
Thank you much, Jeff. If I may come back to the treaty question about Wallenberg, Raoul Wallenberg, and it would be really unjust and unfair not mentioning his name, as it was now mentioned. But let me say that, thanks to God, he was not alone. Names of Karl Lutz, Angelo Rota, or Gabor Stelo were mentioned already this morning. But I would add also some Hungarian nuns, Margit Schlachter, who were very, very active in saving children and innocent lives at that time. Or the father of the first democratically elected Hungarian prime minister, Antal József, being at that time deputy state secretary and who was responsible for the refugee affairs. Mind you, Hungary hosted and homed many, many hundreds of thousands of refugees during the war from other countries, including Jews and non-Jews. So he himself was declared one of the righteous. He saved a lot of Jewish lives. There was one Hungarian count, member of the then Slovak parliament, who was the only one who refused to vote for the anti-Jewish laws. He saved personally Jewish lives. He is still not recognized among the writers. But according to the Yad Vashem's archives, now they are 895 non-famous Hungarians who did risk their lives in order to save others. They were more, many more, but they were not enough. On the other question, which was related to the Esperanto movement and George Soros, let me come back to the beginning of your question, when you said that George Soros, the most famous Hungarian Jew. I'm not aware of any contest of this kind. But let me remind some other names as well for our collective recollection. You might have heard about the Manhattan Project. 4 out of the 5 key personalities of the Manhattan Projects were Hungarians, mathematicians and physicians. There was a secret language, and it was a small signboard on one of the rooms of the Columbia University where they actually had their meetings, written, "It's not enough to speak only Hungarian if you enter here." But you may also know some other names. Let me just mention Hungarian-American connections. Andrew Teller. Some of you may like him, some others not. He was considered the father of the hydrogen bomb. One of the greatest physicists in the second half of the century, 20th century. You may also heard about Kálmán Tódor, who was the father of the helicopter. Yes. You may have heard about János Neumann, yes, one of the best mathematicians on earth ever lived, who created the concept of the computer mathematically. You might have heard about the hologram, which was created by Hungarian who later became a citizen of this country and UK actually, Gábor Dénes. Or talking about the fames, certainly Tom Lantos belongs to the Hall of Fame. And who was cited here this morning, a Holocaust survivor, Elie Wiesel, who speaks a much better Hungarian than I do. And not forgetting those who did a lot for Hollywood. You may remember the name of George Zucker, Tony Curtis, and many others. So if there would be once a competition for the title, I think there will be a large crowd to race for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're running out of time. However, I know there are a lot of more questions out there. We're going to take 2 more from the floor and 2 from Twitter. Please, if I don't speak, call on you, accept my apologies ahead of time. I know it's there will be a lot of hands up. So I'll read the... But before we go on, there was a question about Peter Ginz. If you don't happen to know the Holocaust program here at the United Nations, which is managed by Kimberly Mann. Are you still in the room, Kimberly? I saw her before. Are you here? Yes. Has worked with an external partner to create an absolutely wonderful educational guide based on the life and artistic work of Peter Ginz, the boy who perished during the Holocaust. It's one of the wonderful outputs of the program. So just in case you didn't know about it, it's something that you should all be aware of, in addition to the many other educational materials that the program produces to help prevent genocide. So I'll start with the Twitter questions, and then we'll take 2 from the floor. Please, both in the questions and in the responses, because we're short on time, be very, very brief. So the Twitter question, the first one is, what can the UN do to promote best practices for fighting anti-Semitism today? And another question, this one for Ms. Vertis specifically, is can you just give us a feeling for what life was like right after the war? Briefly, I know that could be a long one, just very, very briefly in a couple of words, and then 2 questions. Yes, in the purple.
Rescuers, you may have a name, Raoul Wallenberg or Perlaska, but those people had many, many, many people who helped them. They did not do it alone. They're the figurehead. They get honored at Yad Vashem, but I have interviewed many rescuers, and they had a lot of help from people just because they were not bystanders. A lot of the people helped just bringing food. So always remember in your chats to say, yes, this is the rescuer that gets the name and the medal on Yad Vashem, but they all had a lot of help. in that. And I think that needs to be told over and over again. It goes with the theme, not being a bystander. Thank you.
Thank you. Last question. Okay, the gentleman, no, I'm sorry, the woman, the, yeah. behind you in the beige.
Hi, Rosalie Keach, League of Women Voters of the U.S. Actually, my Twitter question was a little bit skewed, and I just want to clarify it because I think that there was an important nuance there. The question I asked is, how can the U.N. promote best practices in fighting anti-Semitism so that governments today do not persecute or officially sponsor persecution of its citizenship? It's a lesson of the Holocaust in order to promote peace today.
Thank you for the clarification. All right, we'll take the responses now. Perhaps we can begin with Dr. Rittner.
Since I'm not a member of the United Nations, I think that that those of you who are NGOs here or ambassadors or staff people really should reply to this question about how the United Nations can, what the best practices are. That's all I'll say about that.
The question was about after the war, how were my experiences? After the war, as I already mentioned, nobody helped us, and I had terrible nightmares. I couldn't go to school because I couldn't sleep at night. And other things is that Hungary had the great misfortune of being ruled by the Russians, the Soviets, I should say. In those days, they were Soviets. And communism came into Hungary. And because my family owned a very big business, we were considered capitalists, and we were considered enemies of the people. And they took away my father's business, which he started again. And then, you know, if you were an enemy, nobody hired you. If you didn't work, they put you in jail. So it was a catch-22. So life was not very good. And eventually, they did put my father into jail. And he was tortured almost to death. And he only was freed at the death of Stalin when there was a general amnesty.
Thank you, Ambassador.
Thank you much. First, back to Wallenberg. Yes, I fully agree. Thanks to God, there were many helpers to him as well. The last year in my country was dedicated to him. It was a Wallenberg year, and not only to remember him, but to remember how many and who were there who helped him, and what was the cause they represented. On what UN can, should, and is doing. Thanks to God, it's happening. Although it's a question of many political debates in the walls of this house, but we have to make sure that if it is about a genocide, no crime should go without having the perpetrators held accountable. We need the good mechanisms for that. We need the good international judiciary system for that. And we need the joint political will to execute our will, execute our decisions, that no war criminal should go unpunished. The other, what the UN can do and is doing, and I'm very, very grateful for DPI, we are here today. We are sharing the ideas, we are sharing the impressions, we are sharing the personal stories to remember, to learn, and to share it with many millions through internet. we have to remember it is not a story to be told once. It's a story to live with us, not in order to live and remain in the Valley of Shadows, but to learn what was done wrong and to learn where is the way out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I'm informed we do have a little bit of extra time, so we're going to take two more questions. We had there and the gentleman there, and then we're going to wrap up. Thank you. Yes.
Hi. Gloria Landy, World Council of Conservatives, Masorti Synagogues. Last May, I was in Budapest with the World Jewish Congress for a big conference, and we wanted to go around. It's so beautiful, but we were not allowed to move around freely. We had very, very heavy security constantly because of the threat of the Krautiks. So how do you explain that, and are they still as powerful as they were at that time? If you know the Krautiks that I'm referring to. Okay, it is on now again. The Krautik Party. They kept us. We had to have heavy security to be protected against them because they were issuing threats and they didn't want us there. That was the World Jewish Congress who had a conference in Budapest.
Thank you, sir. The last question.
Happy New Year, everybody here. My name is Nana Yabani of Olof Palme Peace Foundation. I'm very sad to hear what went on in Hungary. I've read about it and I'm hearing it. And every time I hear it, I feel so bad because we have to ask ourselves, are we human beings or not? The most annoying thing is that all this talk, how do we stop all this thing? Is that we cannot stop it unless we are able to talk to the government who finance Germany. You know, Germany didn't have money. But when they start selling, America was buying, Britain was buying, everybody was buying, and Germany became power. If we cannot be able to stop this nonsense, then the world genocide will go on. We can see South Africa killing blacks. It will go on because the people are still supplying the arms and the people don't make arms. It's the government who make arms. So let's be honest and start telling the government not to encourage or support any genocide or everything that's happened in the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ambassador, maybe you would like to address the first question.
Yes. Thank you very much. I understand we are talking about the party named Jobbik, which in the first time of the history, since 1990, they made it to the parliament. They garner about 10% of the votes. They are in the parliament. They have their own fraction. And they are considered as far right. And in many instances, they test the limits of what can you qualify legally as anti-Semitism. This is the bad news. The good news, that they are very much isolated within the parliament and outside of the parliament. Unfortunately, radicalism still exist in many societies, including in mine, left or right. What is very, very important, that there should be sober and healthy instinct of each and every society to make sure that there should be a firewall. I can assure you that in Budapest, where you find one of the largest and most flourishing Jewish communities in Europe, you can walk freely. If you go for a large conference, not only on the Jewish World Congress, but I was there a short while ago for a World Water Summit, there is security. And it's not necessarily because of anti-Semitism. Because unfortunately, for the same reasons, you have security when you enter here in the United Nations, or when you go to celebrate the New Year Eve on the Times Square. When we have a large crowd of people, unfortunately, we are exposed to factors what we would like to see them as gone. They are still around. But I'm not going to talk away the anti-Semitism. It exists in my country as well. But the only proper policy, I think, towards them is zero tolerance. And that's exactly what my government is pursuing. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll just give each of the panelists an opportunity to wrap up and provide one final thought. If you want to keep in mind the statement about financing and arms and the role of that, access to that in perpetrating genocide, please feel free to do so. So just a very quick closing thoughts before we wrap up.
I would just like to say that there was a discussion here about the Pope, and the truth is he never gave any directions to his people, and so the priests did whatever they felt like. Some were saving Jews, and some, Angelo Rota was helping Jews, and another person happened to be a Catholic priest who simply murdered my family who were hiding on the Buddha side. So what I'd like to say is that you cannot generalize, but there were on both sides. The church was on both sides, and before the Holocaust, they were reading papal letters and all sorts of anti-Semitic letters to rile up the population. So I just wanted to add this.
Thank you. Dr. Rittner.
I think my concluding comments are my concluding comments from my prepared lecture, and that is never be a perpetrator, never be a victim, and never but never be a bystander.
Ambassador.
Thank you much. My concluding remark would be an invitation to you. If you can, please join us this evening at 6 o'clock for the inauguration of the exhibition done by NGOs on the story what we are discussing this morning. And as a really closing remark, I would like to thank you all for making through under this biting frost, sharing your ideas, your questions, and sharing your interest with us. It's very important. Thank you indeed.
Thank you all. I'd like to echo those thanks. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you for being a wonderful audience and courteous, and for sharing excellent questions and thoughts and succinctly. So the briefing is over, but we do have a few announcements to make for the NGO community. So if you're interested in those, please stay with us. If not, please try and exit quietly so that we can continue with the last portion of this event. So I'd like to give the floor to Anne-Marie Carlson, the chair of the NGO DPI Executive Committee, to share some announcements. Hold on, we're waiting for you. There we go.
On behalf of the NGO DPI Executive Committee, and I think everyone here today and listening, I'd like to very much thank our panelists for providing such a meaningful and powerful presentation. I think one that we will all long remember, and we'll be looking to get even more information. But on the other hand, I have a very important announcement. Some of you might have heard this already, but we're very excited about this. At the end of August, August 28th and 29th, that's a Thursday and Friday, we will be having a conference here at the UN for NGOs from all over the world. We're expecting perhaps 1,500 to be coming here to the UN for what we used to be calling an annual conference, but what we've been not been able to have the last few years. But this summer, the end of August 2014, we will be having one. In addition to Thursday the 28th and 29th, we're hoping to have a few events going on Wednesday the 27th and Saturday also. So stay tuned as we're working to get more and more in place. I don't know if Jeff Huffines was able to come here this morning. I was hoping he could, but let me just make the announcement that Jeff Huffines has been chosen to be the NGO co-chair for right now. That's up until the actual conference when he becomes the chair of the conference. And his co-chair from the DPI side is right in front of us today, Jeff Brez. So we're really thrilled to have both Jeffs as co-chairs for the upcoming NGO DPI conference. For more information, do look at the recent issue of the NGO Reporter, which just came out earlier this week, and you can find that on the Executive Committee website. Again, congratulations to both Jeffs. And stay tuned for more on the conference.
Thank you, Anne-Marie, and thank you all. Thank you to our panelists. And the last announcement is next week, come to our briefing. It starts not at 10, but 11. Note the time change, 11 a.m., next door in Conference Room 3. It's a Q&A with Undersecretary General Peter Lonski-Tiefenthal. Thank you.